It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to another special political party replay where I go through the back catalogue and pick out one of my favourites, and this is a Christmas special. This is from Christmas 2016 and features Alistair Campbell and Ed Balls. Now, if you were there on the night or if you listened to it at the time, you will know. Very early on, it dawns on me that Alistair and Ed may not have actually had this conversation before about the whole Blair Brown thing and the end of the last Labour government. And it was only when I was sat on stage with them, Ed, by the way, just on Strictly, and Alistair ends up playing the bagpipes while Ed dances. I mean, it's as batshit as it sounds, but it starts off, and I remember thinking, oh my God. You know, I always try and book guests that I think will be a good mix, that'll be a good laugh. And obviously, Alistair and Ed are always phenomenal guests. But at the start, I thought, oh my God. That they've never really had it out, so to speak. So this was electric in a way that I probably should have foreseen, but didn't. So yes, this is part of a replay series that I'm doing while I'm in hospital, recovering from surgery and having physio and stuff. So I've pre-recorded all these interviews just in case you think, well, he sounds perfectly fine. Why isn't he at work? That's why. So anyway. Jingle bells and all that business, because it is Christmas 2016 with Alistair Campbell and Ed Balls. Brace yourself.
Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we have a huge first guest of this evening. Two, obviously, massive guests. Please, he's been a guest before, he's always fantastic. Give a huge welcome to Alistair Campbell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matt.
Good song, though, eh?
Right, yeah.
Did you get it?
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be hearing more from MP4 just before the break, but for now, we're going to say goodbye to our fantastic Alice fan. Give it up for MP4! Thank you, Jeff. It's Christmas.
Yes.
Would you do a cracker with me?
Go on then.
Oh. Very violent.
Good joke.
So pop the hat on and read the joke. Oh. Against a paperclip to keep all your invoices together.
Well, I won't be needing one from tonight.
The joke. Have you done a Christmas cracker before? What? Oh, do you need your glasses? I think there might be a pair in this, actually.
What kind of cough medicine does Dracula take?
I don't know. What kind of cough medicine does Dracula take?
Con medicine.
What?
I literally don't get that on any level. Am I reading that right?
That would be better, coughing medicine. What kind of cough medicine does Dracula take? Con medicine. It's more of a riddle than a joke, isn't it? Well, there you go. You has someone got on this one, eh?
Have you got your own jokes here, are you reading?
You've got to wear the hat for a bit. It's Christmas, come on.
Somebody will take a picture and it'll look ridiculous.
Oh, here we are. What animal needs oiling? Mice, because they squeak. Yeah, I think Ian calls you, we're doing that at the next MP4 gig. So, Alistair, last time you were here...
I'm only putting my hat on if you put it on.
I'll put it on. Feel free to take photos, by the way. The front fear is allowed. You look great.
Thank you.
Look how happy you look.
Thank you.
You know what you look like? This scene looks like the only guy you couldn't pull at the Christmas party. Look at him, Mr. Miserable over there.
got my chair here.
You got your chair?
Just waiting.
She's running late. Don't you fucking move. Now, the last time you came into the political party show, it ended with you calling a member of the audience a wanker. Oh.
Is he back?
Well, I don't know, is he back? No, you've still had shock.
Why did I?
He questioned you about Tony Blair's income.
Okay.
And his role in the Middle East.
Okay.
And suggested it was slightly ironic, given his previous role in the Middle East. And you called him a wanker. Oh, no, that was it. I said I wanted a one-sentence answer, and you went, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a one-word answer. Wanker. And you're wearing the same hat as well, which is...
Right.
Which has really brought an atmosphere.
No, it wouldn't have been just for that. You probably annoyed me.
Probably looked at you funny.
Yeah.
Probably had a girlfriend or something.
He didn't drape his hand over the chair like this. Pull it closer.
We should say, by the way, during the break, Alistair and Ed will be signing copies of their new books in the foyer during the break and after the show. You can get them during the break.
And if you buy them.
Well, of course.
Otherwise, I'll have nothing to invoice for. Apart from the cab fare.
I've paid for that.
Oh, no, thank you.
Anyway, let's not go into the details of me having to pay for Alistair's
travel. He's also got a selection box. It's nice.
Yeah, don't start fucking... Yeah, I think it's
right.
Nice.
It is nice.
And I got you a special book, didn't I?
And also, as I'm trying not to eat chocolate at the moment, I'll give my selection box for the best question in the second half.
Oh.
What are you going to give?
Actually, I've got two copies of your book to give away, but... Certainly not as impressive as a selection box. Exactly. Now, the one thing I've been dying to ask you since it happened was about that Question Time appearance of John McDonnell. Because it was... Ooh, it was fairly fruity on stage, but then afterwards, apparently, it kicked off, according to certain websites. I mean, how true is the...
Websites? Is that the non-MSM? Is that where we're talking about?
That's right, yeah, the Canary.
I think it was in the MSM as well. Yeah.
So what actually happened?
It was all a bit odd, to be honest. It really was quite odd, because I am not very good at...
Question Time.
No, I'm very good. I'm very, very good at Question Time, which is why I get asked often once for every 11 appearances by Nigel Farage. But what happened was that my daughter is writing a sitcom at the moment.
Ooh.
Called Politician's Kids. And one of her episodes is going to be set in Question Time. This wasn't the only reason I did it, but, you know. And you probably know that Jeremy Corbyn's son, Seb, is John McDonnell's right-hand man.
That's right.
So during the programme, as it was being recorded, you had the block, the audience there, and then over there, in this bit, a big empty block, just two people, my daughter and Seb Corbyn, sitting next to each other. And just as Seb... no doubt at the moment has a lot of sort of, you know, stuff going on because his dad's in the public eye and gets a lot of grief in the press and the rest of it. My daughter's had a lot of that all of her life. And so I was really, really, really trying to be nice to John McDonnell. Because, and I really, really was trying. I didn't want anything to kick off.
Yeah.
With me and him. And I was even, and I'm not very good at this, I was even sort of suggesting that New Labour had been other than completely 100% perfect.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know you don't agree.
Treachery.
I know you don't agree, but I was just sort of... And so I was sort of saying, yeah, we could have done this better and we did that, that I was really trying. And then suddenly, left field, out of nowhere, this is totally nauseating. And I was like, are you talking to me? It was. And then so it just sort of... So afterwards, I said to him, I said, look, you know, you couldn't resist it. And he said, well, you know, why did you side with Anna Soubry? I said, well, I didn't. I was actually... Da-da-da. And so, yeah, it got a bit... Anyway, fast forward, and my daughter came in and said, Dad, we're going. So we went.
So what was the... Was it, like, properly squaring up to each other and threatening to take it outside?
No. Well, I was quite angry.
I'll be John McDonnell and you be you.
Right.
Okay. I said, bloody hell, Alistair, this is nauseating. Right. There are workers in Redcar. It always seems to bring up in any conversation. I changed my mind when I went to Redcar.
Yeah. He didn't say that. He said you couldn't resist siding with the Tory. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, bloody Anna Soubry, I saw her out there. I was sat out there with... It sounds like, what's his face? Some
Bernard
porridge. Oh, Fletcher. I don't think there's any need.
No, I did question whether he really, really, really wanted to win.
What did he say?
Oh, yeah, we're going to win. We'll win with that year. don't you worry, we'll win. Fair enough.
Because I suppose it was a literal sort of embodiment of the tensions in the Labour Party, wasn't it, you and him? The two directions that the party could take.
It didn't feel like that. I mean, it was like... I mean, I've been very, very clear since Jeremy Corbyn got elected. I really, really can't stand the idea of becoming a kind of rent-a-quote, going out there just slagging off everything he says and does.
Thanks for coming on the show, by the way.
And now that we've got Donald Trump, I don't feel I have to do that. But I think that, you know, people keep saying that what they like about Jeremy Corbyn is that, you know, he's authentic and he's true and he says what he thinks. Well, you don't have a monopoly on that. And I'm authentic and true, and I say what I think, and I find it very difficult not to. Mm. So if I'm in a public forum and I'm asked, what do I think the Labour Party needs to do to win, I'm not going to pretend that everything is great at the moment, because it's not.
SNP here.
In terms of Corbyn as an individual, what sort of relationship have you ever had with him? Is it courteous?
I guess so. I mean, it's really weird that on the day of the election, I was down on College Green.
Yeah. Not being a rent-a-quote.
Putting a strategic case for what is going on. Now, I think you know this, I was not surprised that David Cameron got a majority. But anyway, most people were. And I was wandering around, and this Radio 5 producer sort of grabbed me and said, can you come and do Peter Allen? I said, yeah. I said, what? Can't you get Kevin Maguire? And so... and any other rent-a-quotes. So I go in there, and Jeremy Corbyn's sitting there. So then they said, do you mind doing it with Alistair? Do you mind doing it with Jeremy? We both said no. And I thought about it a lot, because if I'd have said then, when Peter Allen said, okay, Jeremy, okay, Alistair, what happens next? If I'd have said, well, what happens next is that Jeremy's going to be the next leader of the Labour Party, I'd have been taken out and shot them. So you were mad. And so... But he was. And so, yeah, I'd say courteous, but... I'll tell you what I felt from the John McDonnell thing. I felt it really quite strongly. I really do believe that he and some of his people loathe us much more than they loathe Tories. Yeah. I really feel that. And I think it's like... I mean, I thought it was interesting that Anna Soubry sitting there and says, you're a horrible little man. You know, I think you're evil. And yet... It's me as a goer for sitting there suggesting it might be a really good thing if the Labour Party really, really, really tried to be obsessed about winning, which I think would be a good thing.
But don't you think that the issue with saying that is that when you talk about winning for its own... It sounds like you're talking about winning for its own
ends. I'm not.
But they think you are.
Well,
they think you will sacrifice anything to get into power.
But I wouldn't, and nor would any of the people that were involved, nor would have Ed Balls, nor would any of the other people that were involved in
what. But the right of the party has sort of seeded that, hasn't it? There is a sort of that argument hasn't been properly put as a fight back, that actually New Labour values are values in themselves that people genuinely believe in, not just a compromise to win Tory votes.
I never felt that there were times, inevitably, you can't agree with every single thing that you do as part of a big team that gets into government for three terms. But most of the time, I felt completely comfortable with what we were trying to do. And it's just this idea that, you know, we didn't have values, we didn't have principles, we didn't believe what we were doing, we're only doing things to win power. The point we were trying to make the Labour Party see, and make the public see, is that you don't do anything if you don't have power. You literally don't do anything. And what's more, you watch all this stuff happening, and you get angry about it, and you go on protest marches, and you sort of wake up every morning and say, and shout at the radio. But what good does it do you unless you're going to win power?
And I'm like, that is not an individual thing. That's what it really is. And so, and I just think that there's an attempt that you've just articulated. I know you don't believe it, but you've just articulated what they say, which is that we were just obsessed with winning. I don't want to win just for the sake of it. I don't want to win just to do what the Tories are doing now. I wanted to win, and the people in the New Labour team wanted to win to do lots of the stuff that we did. And I don't know who wrote it, but I read this. Somebody sent me this piece today that somebody had written about Northern Ireland and this whole thing about, you know, John McDonnell and to some extent Jeremy sort of talking about their role in the peace process and all the rest of it. And you sort of think, well, you only do things like that if you get into government. You don't do them just by being part of the protest movement. And I worry about where we are. I worry that we're losing that mentality that says it's really good to try and win. And I said, the other thing I said to John, Donald, do you wake up every single day and think, right, for every minute of this day, I'm going to do all the things I need to do to try to get into a position that we're going to win the people who we've lost? The question time was in Salisbury. I can remember we visited Dorset South in 1997. I can remember the journalists saying, this is just a stunt. There's no, it was like when Trump went to Michigan and all those places, oh, is he going there? He's not going to win. We did that in Dorset. You're not going to win in Dorset. We won. Now, they make you feel like, what were you doing trying to win there? That's not a Labour area. Yeah. Correct.
What do you think happens to the Labour Party now? Because I've talked to people that used to be senior members of staff at the Labour Party, some Labour MPs, who truly believe that this could be like the collapse of the Liberal Party.
Liberal England, yeah.
That this could be the same level, that the Labour Party actually may not exist as a parliamentary force in 15 to 20 years' time.
I hope that's not the case. But I think if you look at, you see, I think it's interesting that Trump winning, Brexit winning, the Corbynista people are sort of saying, well, that shows it. That shows we can do the same.
Yeah.
Fight, do it against the odds. Well, maybe. But think about it going in the other direction. What it shows. No political party has an existential right to exist. And I do worry. I do genuinely worry about where we are now.
Because you've been there before during the dark days of the 70s and 80s where people said Labour would never win again. And Labour found a way back and you were a big part of that. Do you think this is a bigger crisis now than it was, say, under Michael Foot?
I think it could be. It obviously depends what happens. But I think, I can remember 1992, Peter Jenkins, the commentator, he and I, on College Green, there's a couple of renter quotes on the day after that. And I can remember Peter saying, after John Major had just beaten Neil Kinnock, if Labour can't win in these circumstances, we have to conclude they'll never win another election. Now, 5 years later, we've got a landslide. So you can't say for sure. But I feel at the moment, you have to, there's no point. What did I hear yesterday? I hear them, you know, all these really, really bad polls. And Jeremy's done an interview, I think, in the New Statesman saying, well, that's because we have the year-long thing, you know, the internecine warfare took out the ball. Once people, and also the mainstream media are against us, and I'm winning on social media, and da-da-da-da. And I thought, fine, if you're saying that just to sort of make yourself feel better. But it's pointless if you really believe that, because it's not true. You have to listen. And Jeremy probably is going around, because there are a lot of people who like him, and a lot of people are motivated by him. He did bring a lot of people into the party. But if he just goes around talking to those people, and he doesn't get the sense that I get, I travel around the country all the time, and you get people just literally coming up and talking to you all the time. And sometimes people do say, why can't you sort of say something nice about Jeremy Corbyn? Sometimes people say, you know, really, really unpleasant things to me. But 9 times out of 10, Labour people at the moment are saying, what are we going to do? This is desperate.
So how does the Labour Party, your side of the Labour Party, wrestle it back from Corbyn? Because with the model that the Labour Party has of choosing its leader, as long as he has enough numbers in the membership, you're going to have to get 2, 3, maybe 400,000 moderate people that are just out there and haven't yet joined the Labour Party to mobilise.
Well, when you said, does this feel worse than the 80s? The reason why partly it does is that during that period, I could always sort of feel and see that there was something there that would change it. I mean, I could envisage a situation, I don't want to, but I could envisage a situation where the Tories get back in and get back in quite comfortably, and Jeremy just thinks, oh, well, go again, or Donald will do it, or Diane Abbott, or, you know. And I think it's...
We're very cold, very quickly. Like a seance when you mentioned those names.
But, you know, so obviously a lot depends on... That's where you can't accurately predict. But I do feel at the moment that we're... You have to, one of the things I think we did always try to do, no matter what you're trying to project in terms of a confident public posture, one thing, I can remember Philip Gould and I, we used to have this weekly meeting, we'd sit down, and on the agenda was one item. If we were the Tories, and we knew what we know about ourselves, what would we do about it? Mm. Which is not a bad way to think of things, because you're in a fight with them, that's who you're fighting. And I just don't get that sense that they do have that same zeal and hunger and desire. And it's interesting, you know, when Jeremy's had his two leadership elections on, you've seen the zeal, you've seen the hunger, you've seen the fight, you've seen the organisation.
Yeah.
Since, it's felt a bit...
Because people are looking for individuals, aren't they? People who perhaps may have served before. Maybe former leaders of parties that might choose to play a role again. And Tony Blair's name has been mentioned as someone who might... I mean, he himself is gearing up, isn't he, for something. Are you involved in that?
Yeah.
So what is it?
He's got a lot of money. He's gonna help me buy a Premier League football club. Called Burnley. No, I'll tell you what he's gonna do. I think it's sad the way that Tony is perceived. Because one, there's two things that go on. One, the Blair haters want to say all he ever did was Iraq. And that was 100% of the people in the entire world think that was the worst mistake that any politician has ever made. And the second thing they want to say is that all he's ever done since he left office is go and get himself rich, and he doesn't care about the world anymore. And none of those things are true. Yes, he's made a lot of money. He employs 250 people. A lot of them worked on big pro bono projects in some of the poorest parts of the world. You never, ever, ever hear or read about them in MSM, or indeed on SM, because you're not allowed. It's just not the done thing, social media. I know we're in Soho, but, you know, it's not that. It's just not the done thing to say anything nice about Tony Blair, ever, in any polite company. You might as well fart very loudly. So
I often do both.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. I heard you in the dressing room. But so what I think, the thing about what I do think, you see, I think when Tony left office, I think for the right reasons, he vacated the field. He left it to Gordon. I think it was the right thing to do. And what it meant, though, is that he left the definition of him. And then all these stories, relentless in the Mail, the Telegraph, elsewhere, about his money, his money, his money, his money, I think that has had a bit bad impact upon how he's perceived. But I see him as, yes, of course he has a nice lifestyle and he goes around on private planes and all that, but I see him doing public service in a different sort of way. And I think what he feels, this thing that you were talking about, I think he feels that he vacated the domestic political debate too much. And given his experience and given his insight and given his knowledge, he needs to make more of a contribution in that. It does not mean he's going to stand for Parliament.
And it's not going to be a think tank. So what is it? It'll have staff, but what will it do if it's not a think tank and it's not a movement to get someone elected? Or not to get him elected?
It'll do all sorts of different things. It will be part of policy debate. I think it's supporting different people. I think one of the best things about the Labour Party is that there are, for all the kind of negativity and all the faults, there are loads and loads and loads of young people who are getting involved and getting into the Labour Party. I know that Tony sees a lot of the younger MPs now, and of course when that gets out there, it's all plotting against Jeremy, da, da, da. Often it's actually about trying to find out where the talent lies and who's got ability and who's having interesting arguments, who's coming up with things, and I do that as well. I think, you know, I think all of us have a responsibility to sort of put something back, and part of that is trying to bring talent on, because that's something we didn't do very well.
So it's kind of academy for MPs, where they can sort of go and improve and become better.
No.
No, it's so not like do you talk to him much?
Yes.
And he would just ring you how often?
Regularly.
So you get phone call and say, "Hi, Alistair."
He's actually one of the few people who I'm afraid who calls me Ali, which is sort of...
Ali?
Yeah, I know.
So you go, "Oh, hi, Ali."
He doesn't, because it's... No, he doesn't do that. No.
Ali!
No.
Ali, Ali, Ali.
He says... Ed Balls is looking at his phone over there. He's bored. He said, he says, "Hi, it's me."
And you say, "Hi, Tony." He says, "Look, about this thing that's not a think tank, that's not an academy, that's more about you getting elected."
He doesn't,
whatever it is.
He doesn't feel he has to explain it until we speak.
No one
can explain. It's like Donald Trump with the intelligence. He doesn't have to read it every day to see the same thing. Because I'm really smart as well, you see. Like, I know what Tony's going to say before he's said it.
So then he'd say, "Look, it'd be great if you could be involved in whatever it is that you're..." Obviously, don't need to explain it because we're on the same page. And that's fine. But
I'll tell you what, you take your hat off. How are you doing with that?
Mine fell off.
Mine's going off.
I'm going to rub my head back. Well, I think we should introduce our second.
Do we do Parkinson's? Do I move up now?
If that's okay, yeah.
That's fine.
Are you two going to be okay?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. So I was slightly worried when I booked you together.
Was that volume 1 or volume 2 or volume 3 or volume 4? Volume 5 is really good, isn't it? Yeah.
Okay, well, let's start on volume 1 and we can sort of reenact the ages. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a phenomenal second guest. Again, been a star on the show before, as well as being one of the most defining politicians of the New Labour era, has gone on to be a genuine showbiz star. He's an absolute hero. Please, give a huge welcome to Ed Balls!
Big hug.
In
volume 3.
In Strictly, we hug anybody. I actually, I have to admit, I was standing behind there on my phone. I was just finding out.
We'll have the Burnley.
Because Norwich won on there. Tuesday.
We lost.
I know, I was just checking that, so then I thought I then wouldn't bring it up.
Yeah, this will be cool, because there must have been a period, actually, where you two were kind of rivals, or working for rivals, and what was your relationship like at the peak of what they called the TBGBs?
It was
a bit high.
It was fine most of the time.
I don't think we ever had a bad row.
So there were rounds.
Yeah.
Not really. I think the thing was... I'm going to tell you what I think. I thought it was our job to try and make it work. And most of the time, we didn't do too badly.
The one I had trouble with was Charlie Whelan, as you know. Yeah. Is here as well?
No, but a couple of cows. He's like...
and my next guest... No, you're all right.
No, I think Ed and I didn't fall out. But it was very, very difficult when the Tony Gordon thing was bad. It was. No doubt about that.
And have you, sort of as individuals or people who've worked on both sides of that divide, ever sort of sat down and talked about it until now, exclusively live on this podcast?
We went out to that that fish restaurant in Covent Garden.
We did. Live bait.
Live bait.
Yeah, we did.
And so, yeah, we had some.
And then we went to our therapist.
And then Alistair gave me a number and I signed up with it. His therapist has been really useful.
Well, that's good. I wasn't sure if you were joking or not.
I'm a therapist?
Yeah.
No. I wasn't. No, I'll tell you, you remember the Class of 92 film?
Yes.
The guy who made that, Gabe Turner, he was a friend of mine, and he came to see me and he said, "Listen, I've got this great idea to follow up to Class of 92, Class of 97. You lot, Tony Gordon, you, Mandelson, get you all round like the Neville brothers in Scotland.
Yeah, yeah.
Sit around the table. And anyway, I phoned up your mate, Tony. He said, "Are you going to come?" It's sad though, it wouldn't happen. It wouldn't happen.
Don't you think in time he would?
And Gordon would have said, "Absolutely not."
Is this one of Alistair's crazy ideas?
I've still not forgiven that briefing to the Observer in 1998.
Was that the one I denied?
Psychological flaws.
These guys.
But that was the one, wasn't it?
What they're doing.
So how would Gordon talk about this? Is great. How would
these guys? Is that what they're doing?
That's what he'd say. And how would Tony talk about Gordon's
always,
phone?
Always Campbell.
Yeah, but when it came to his election, he said, "Can you come and help me?" I did.
Thank
you.
No, I think that's really important, though. In all the elections, there were tensions in the election campaigns, but I don't actually remember in 2001, 2005, there being tensions between the core people. We got on with it.
No, the big tension in 2005, volume 5, was Gordon, Alan Milburn, Gordon not wanting really to be part of it, unless he had a pretty clear signal about what was going to happen in the third term.
Well, but also, in the previous September, Gordon had been sort of ditched in favour of Alan.
I didn't mean ditched, I think Alan had been brought in. I think Alan had been brought in to help put together...
2004 had been a rocky summer.
Gordon was the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
He was busy.
Right, we had to have somebody preparing the campaign.
I spent the... I'm not sure if it's in your diaries, but I spent... I spent about 2.5 hours walking round a zoo in Keswick, right, in the Easter of 2005, with these long conversations, I think with you, certainly with Philip, all about how we're going
to
find...
I've never been to a zoo in Keswick.
No, I was in the zoo, on the phone. With this whole long conversation about how we would find a way to get Gordon to come back in and to make it good again. And we did. Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So we solved a problem which people had created the previous September.
Or indeed, 11 years earlier.
I know.
Does this feel cathartic for you both?
I think we're beyond catharsis, aren't we? We're kind of, it's all...
Yeah. I mean,
we can talk quite openly about it because it's both really important, but there's also humour in it, and we all came out the other side. It's fine.
I don't think it's totally fine.
The difference is, I wrote a book which was how I felt about it afterwards, whereas you've got these bloody diaries which are contemporary.
I know,
so you keep having to read what you thought 10 years ago. I've forgotten that.
I know, but I'll tell you what I do think. I still feel, back to the class of 92 thing, if we, the whole New Labour lot, all of us, I know this is impossible and it's idealistic, but if we all had been able to operate at our best, at our most united, all the time, we'd still be there.
You're totally right.
I believe
it. And actually, to be... And I fundamentally blame Tony and Gordon for that. Because actually, they were the big guys who'd been around a long time, and they should have seen that they were stronger together than being pulled apart. And the reality was, what happened was, because we had a landslide in 97, and then in particular, because the Tories collapsed so badly after 2001, and they end up, there's an important parallel with what's happening now in politics. If the opposition collapses and becomes very weak, and that's what happened with Ian Duncan Smith, the only story in town becomes the argument within the governing party, and, you know, if you had a prime minister who's been there quite a long time, it becomes about succession. And so there was continually people positioning, was it going to be Gordon, was Gordon going to be stopped? And that was because the Tories were too weak. And Theresa May, you know, I think needs a stronger opposition if she's to stop the biggest story being the divisions in the Conservative Party. But Gordon and Tony should have gone top of that, and they didn't. Both.
Yeah. Well.
Equally, I'm not taking sides.
Okay. I'm going to take sides a bit.
So you're not over it?
No. Not totally, no. No, I'll tell you why, because I think that one of the things that people have been saying recently about you, in fact, Fiona said it the other day about, you know, Strictly stuff. She said, you know, and I was making the point, I said this to Matt, that I think it says something bad about our political culture and our media culture, that you're actually the same person as you always were, but you go and do a TV programme like that, and only when you do something like that can people say, oh, he's showing a human side. Well, he's always had a human side. And so I think that my whole thing about the reason I think diaries are a good way of saying what politics is like, I think it's really important, as I'm all politicians, human beings, all the time. These guys play this music. I mean, they don't have to do it. They've got interests outside politics, like we all have. But the point I think about Tony and Gordon as human beings, I don't think Gordon ever really accepted that Tony should have been leader of the Labour Party in 1994. I think that was the starting of the kind of fissure was there. I think Tony was incredibly tolerant for lots of it. And he ultimately had to make a decision. He only could only do one of two things, sack him or keep him. And I said in somewhere recently that I sometimes I think, this is why it's not a question of not being over it, but I don't always know the answer or the answer changes. Sometimes I think he should have done, most of the time I think he shouldn't. But I just think it's sad that we couldn't hold together. And actually, Gabe Turner is, I think, never ever going to be able to make that film.
Well, hopefully one day we'll leave it there for now. We're going to take a break and we'll be back. But before we take a break, please welcome back on MP4. For a very special song, this. We're going to play, it's the song that is for the Joe Cox Memorial Trust, isn't it, Ian? That is released tomorrow on iTunes. In a bit.
We're going outside. Look, I'm not going unless Matt comes.
Oh, well, I'll stand in between the barriers. You'll be fine. Oh, he's not sure to get his ass kicked. Right. Ian, explain to us what the song is.
Okay, the song is a Rolling Stones classic, You Can't Always Get What You Want. It's available on iTunes and Amazon tomorrow. And if enough of you buy it, it might be the Christmas number one. Yeah. And all the money is going to the Joe Cox Foundation. All of the artists who performed on that did it for free. We've got David Gray, Ricky Wilson, Steve Harley and Katie Tunstall performing, and the Parliamentary Choir.
They're not here tonight.
They're not here tonight, no. And Mick Jagger and Keith Richards have just said today that they're not going to take any publishing out of it as well, so that money will go to the Joe Cox Foundation as well.
I saw her today at the reception.
Indeed. Give it up for MP4 one more time. It was remiss of me at the start, ladies and gentlemen, not to introduce MP4 individually. So please give it up for Mr. Kevin Brennan, Mr. Ian Causey, Sir Greg Knight, and Pete Wishart. First, we've got special walk-on music for Alistair Campbell and Ed Ball. We'll be back later in the show. Well, welcome back, gentlemen. A lot of sign of the books in the break. Good for business?
Very good.
Excellent stuff.
In fact, there's a lot of Alistair's left, but mine are all sold out.
Well, two things. One, he sold out years ago. My publisher's more professional than his, so he sent 100. Sorry, Ed.
Bloody penguin. What's your publisher called?
Ian
Bite Back.
Bite Back.
How appropriate. I was slightly worried in the break there that maybe the tension had spill over, but it's all cool.
We're all fine, Matt. Don't worry.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
No, because it's fascinating to watch, and actually, it was only watching you two talk at the end of the first half there that it really dawned on me that so rarely do you see people who are leading players in such a momentous part of history just sat down talking about it in a funny way, in a civil way, or at all.
Bastard.
No, but it's good. I think this is massively reassuring about seeing you two go through this.
Good.
So Ed, you're now a showbiz star. The last time we spoke, you were still on Strictly, and sadly you left. There must have been a point where you start to believe you could win it.
The algorithm was against me. The way it works is that as it becomes smaller and smaller, the number of contestants in. If you're bottom of the leaderboard, it's basically really, really bad. And the public vote can never be enough. So in the end, I was at the Norwich City AGM a couple of weeks ago. I was chairing the AGM. We beat Aston Villa on Tuesday. Did you win all this? and somebody from the, because we had a bad couple of weeks, and somebody from the audience, there's 600 people, I'm sitting there with the chief executive and the manager, says, Ed, you, in the last few weeks on Strictly, have performed with passion, endeavour and commitment. What have you got to teach the team? And it was a bit embarrassing, but I then pointed out to him that I was bottom of the table every week for 10 weeks. and the football team was still sixth at the time, so actually it was sort of the other way around. They've got stuff to teach me.
But. Oh, there were so many phenomenal weeks that he gave us on Strictly, but I think my favourite, and I think it's one of the best things I've ever seen, was you doing Gangnam Style.
Be pleased to know if you tune in on Saturday night for the final, Gangnam Style will be reprised. another version of it. It was the funny thing about that routine was that to be fair to this guy Sai, he's had 2.5 billion hits on YouTube, so it was a good song. Do you know what I mean? There was, it was good material we were working with. But
were you familiar with the song before you did it for the dance?
I think we were, actually. I think a lot of people were quite familiar with it.
Yeah.
But on the...
but were you?
It was I.
I heard it, but I was
wondering if you had. Definitely. And, and on the Monday, Katya said to me, it's going to be epic, the choreography. And then, because the way it works in the week, I think I said when I was with you a few weeks ago, that you'd film the day's routine and take it home and show the family when you go home. And that bit where you do the jump, which we call the pony, people who saw it during the week were going to go,
what?
Oh! What? And the, but the actual interesting thing about it, for those of you kind of interested in the technicalities of the dance, is the way it works is, I mean, to be fair to Katya, she's got a very strong core, as you may have noticed. But in order for her to grab hold, I have to jump quite hard onto her face. And,
Do you take that bit home as well?
Actually, a friend of mine, Balshu, was working with me. Actually, ran Katya to say, "Are you sure this is okay?" But the biggest problem I had was that I was not giving enough energy, and therefore it was harder to hang on. So you know, so she would yell at me. She'd say, "You've got to jump at me harder." So I did. But did it ever go wrong? That jump?
Yeah.
No. There were many things which went wrong, but not that one.
Because and a lot of the dancing is you're in close proximity with the person you're dancing with. And I've heard some of the professional dancers on Strictly say that some of the male contestants that they dance with, sometimes it's obvious that they've sort of warmed up. Was that a problem you ever had? Sort
of? Well, I did tell you the problem I had very early on, because I learned...
He's not saying no, is he?
I learned quite a lot about showbiz, which I didn't know when I, you know, from the old political world. And so in the very first week, we have this photo call we have to do in Elstree, me and Katya. We had to do like 20 or 30, and it was the photos they used for all the publicity. And so they got all very prepared. And the thing about Strictly is the production values are amazing. So each of us have, the two of us, takes about 2 hours to take these photos. And each of us has our own makeup person, our own hair person, and our own clothes person. And between every shot, the director goes, check, and they all come out, all six, and just sort you out. And and for Katya, it was all quite complicated, but for me, it wasn't that, because things didn't move that much. But there was a lot of dust in the room, and there was this guy who would come out with this thing to take lint off.
Oh, a lint roller?
Yeah, a lint roller. So, about halfway through, he hadn't come out, and I said, excuse me, I said, could I just have the fluffer? And there was this silence. The director said, what? I said, can I have the fluffer back? The guy who takes the fluff off. And they said, you've not done much television or film before. I said, no. They said, this is a pre-Watershed show. Nobody has ever asked for a fluffer before I'm dancing. And I had to go off afterwards and Google it. I had absolutely no idea.
Do you know what a fluffer is?
Yeah.
He was
of course. Of course you do. Of course you do.
The Riviera Jekyll.
Of course you do. So because you know, it's important to rise to the challenge on Strictly Come Dancing. And I did my best.
So you Googled fluffer.
And then discovered that I didn't need one. It was I just needed the guy with the roller. That's all I needed.
It'd be a great item on a TV show, Ed Balls' Internet History. Tweeting your own name and then Googling hardcore porn. So since Strictly...
It was a journey. They say.
At the time, you were riding the crest of a wave, and it was phenomenal because the public really got behind it in a way that... And I don't think it's even the fact that, just because I'm interested in politics, but you were one of the defining TV moments of the year. I think that's absolutely fair to say. After Strictly, has there been a sort of any sense of come down from that?
I think I've...
Yeah. Yvette's in.
I paused thinking, come on, do the line. No, I don't think so. There was a lot of publicity afterwards still. We did a lot more interviews. I went out to America last week. I go out to Harvard to do where I'm a fellow, to meet my other American fellows, and all they wanted to talk about was the cha-cha, bloody cha. They were all watching it on YouTube, so I've not managed to escape from it yet. And as you know, we're Saturday. And then in January and February, I'm doing a 30-date arena tour. Because why wouldn't you? Back in August, there was. I mean, I never even read that bit because it's optional. I was never going to do it. But then after we did Gangnam, and you suddenly think to yourself, you could go and do that pony moment in the O2 in front of 20,000 people, and the organ and jaw. And so we're doing we're playing, you know, arenas around the country.
I mean, as a child,
what's happened to my life? As I said to you, and I was on before, there was this fabulous moment where we were, Catchy was having a row with her husband about who was making the dinner or something, and we're all standing round, and I was, we were doing a bit of VT in a gym in Paddington, and we're standing there doing this sort of film thing, and I'm dressed as a mad scientist with all my hair and blacked out in a white coat, standing there while she's having this row on the phone, and I turned to the director and said, I wanted to be Chancellor. I've had quite a lot of moments like that where you just think, there we are. What, I mean, there's nothing to say, is there, really?
I've got to say, I cannot see Philip Hammond on Strictly Come.
Well, you know.
Would you ever do it?
No.
You'd do it.
I wouldn't, I'm sorry.
That's
no.
What I said.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I don't want to hurt you, Ed, but they did ask me 8 times before they got you. No.
And you never had the guts?
No, I wouldn't. Oh. No, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it.
He's only joking. He wasn't really asked. Were you asked?
I was, yeah.
Oh.
I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't. In fact, Claude and Claudia, yeah, and Tess last night said I was their number one choice to be next year. Oh. Apparently, yeah. From television.
But aren't you already booked to present in the Bake Off?
No.
Are we not saying about that?
The only reality TV I've done
backstage chat. Sorry.
I've done comic like relief.
Fake news. Boom. Fake news. Boom.
I've done The Apprentice comic relief version. Got Piers Morgan.
Yeah, I remember
that. I've done the Soccer Aid. Yeah. And I did that to play with Maradona, which I talk about every single day of my life, and I always will.
You wrote a column about that last week.
I did. I do most weeks. But no, I just couldn't. I wouldn't do it. No, I couldn't do it.
But what would you go in the jungle?
No. No way.
But Celebrity Big Brother?
No.
Normal Big Brother?
I don't. I've got to. I don't. Now you're talking. No, I wouldn't do anything. I wouldn't.
How about Sports Relief Bake Off?
Maybe. Sports Relief. Yeah, that's how they get you. They get you for the charity ones, right? That's fine. But.
Do you have cold fingers or warm fingers?
I've never seen it. I'm sorry to say that. I've never seen it. I'm going to lower the tone here. I'm going to lower the tone here. I don't like this reality TV stuff. And I never have.
Oh, come on.
Sorry, I never have. And I'll tell you what.
There's somebody agrees with you over there.
I think it's. Yeah, but I'll tell you, I think it's one of the reasons. I'm not blaming you, Ed. It's one of the reasons we now have a fucking celebrity apprentice
split over this even,
right? Donald Trump. It's all part of the same thing. People think that it's important to vote in a Strictly Come Dancing as it is to vote in an election. I'm sorry, I don't like it. So I won't do it. Sorry. And I hate Christmas as well.
See, that's fascinating. Why do you hate Christmas? What happened?
Don't.
Is that when she left? As Alistair would say, he's not denying it. Why do you hate Christmas? You can't hate Christmas.
I don't. That was a joke. Made them laugh.
I knew it was a joke. He was carping about it on the way here, said he hated Christmas.
You hate Christmas?
I don't hate Christmas.
It wasn't a joke. Okay.
I tell you that, this must be so hard for you tonight. Because Rory Bremner's sitting there, and he's a proper impersonator.
Oh, here we go.
Come on, let's get going. Everyone.
In your book, Ed, there's a wonderful story about you going into the Department for Children, Schools and Families after you've been Secretary of State, so goes in there now, and you're allowed to go through the files about why they cancelled Building Schools for the Future, which was the Academy Building Programme. And there's a bit in the book where you say there was sort of secret correspondence in this file that you're not sure whether they planted it there, there's some sense for you to read, but you read it anyway. Was there no point during that sort of search that you were worried you'd get caught?
I think, yes. So what happened was, Michael Gove had cancelled building schools for the future straight after the election and told this whole series of schools around the country who had gone through a massive planning process, they weren't going to have a new school built. And we had got the approval because we thought that actually people still doing that kind of infrastructure investment when the economy was still really weak was a good thing. And he then accused me of having gone ahead with these projects without Treasury agreement, which I didn't think was true. And so I then said to the Permanent Secretary, could I come into the department, as you can, to look at the papers to check? And I went in to the Permanent Secretary's office when Michael Gove was the Secretary of State to look through these papers. And in within them, there's a whole series of emails between Michael Gove and his special advisors where he basically says that they're worried there's going to be judicial review against their decision to cancel and how they're going to handle it. And I mean, it would have been quite a slip for them to have been put in there in error. But I didn't know who'd put them in there, and I didn't know what to do, and so I just did extensive notes. if I'd had an iPhone, I would have probably taken photos, but it was pre that era. And then we did say that Michael Gove was worried about the threat of judicial review, and he did get judicial reviewed, and you know, he won, and they cancelled all the schools. But yeah, I did. It's a really funny thing because you don't know when you've basically been presented with a leak in those circumstances. You don't know what the right thing to do is, and whether it was, I'm worried about whether it was a trick, but we were fairly confident it wasn't. And I think in the end, you know, you come out of government and you're trying to persuade the government to change their minds, and in those circumstances, this was, you know, it felt to be illegitimate. And so he was Secretary of State and I won Parliamentarian of the Year, but it was a little compensation.
Because one of the things that he's recently admitted to was that it was a mistake for him to cancel building schools for the future, which many people at the time were sort of telling him. Do you think he did it just out of sort of political spite?
I don't know. I think at the time there was almost a competition between them to be macho. Mm. And
I wonder what
Theresa May was
like.
Announcing massive. We were delivering record investment in schools, hospitals and police at the time. But if you remember, Theresa May had the biggest police cuts ever and the biggest cut in the prison building programme and the biggest cut in the school building programme. And I think that they were trying to prove some. So I think it was quite macho and I think it was pretty stupid.
They were also doing this thing where, like, Theresa May had a very anti-police message, Gove had a very anti-teacher message, yep. And Hunt had a very anti-health worker message. It was incredible.
That's right.
Deliberate strategy. And it's ongoing. So.
Well, that's really brought the tone down a bit. I have to accept my responsibility. I took the question in that direction.
It's a very serious question.
One of the things that is very tantalising about, you mentioned in your book, is going to the Bilderberg Group. Because that is a sort of group apparently steeped in mystery, very secretive, and all types of powerful people from around the world go. You speak very defensively about it in the book. Do you think people are right to be slightly cynical about what happens there?
I think, I think the idea of some big conspiracy is a nonsense. But of course people are going to be cynical or suspicious of anything, whether or not on the inside. And the reality was that I went a few times in the early 2000s and a couple of times, and the people who went from Britain, when I was in opposition, the people who went from Britain were Ken Clark, Peter Mandelson, me, George Osborne, and seven.
Some lizard guy.
Yeah. It was quite right of centre in terms of its orientation, and I think it's quite nice to be on the inside of those things and see how people talk and how they, you know, if you sit in a room where Henry Kissinger is saying what he thinks about the Middle East peace process and it's not made public, you actually if you want to understand these guys, it's quite good to go and see it firsthand.
Do you think there has to be a level of secrecy when people like that get together, or would it?
Well, if it was on the record, it wouldn't happen. If it was public, it wouldn't happen. But there was also 150 people there, so it wasn't exactly, though it was exactly, you know, it wasn't secretive. And every year it happens, it has done. It's one of those things which happened after the Second World War to try and bind America back into Europe again. There's a whole series of these different ones.
That's going well.
I never saw Donald Trump there. I don't think he ever came. And every year they make public what the agenda is and who goes, but they don't. But it's not a public thing. If it's to be honest, I never thought it was that big a deal until the conspiracy stuff happened a couple of years ago, and then they stopped inviting me. Bastards.
But there's this whole apparent ritual where a giant owl is burnt. John Ronson talks about it in his book.
What?
Yeah,
a giant owl is
yeah,
burnt.
Yeah, there's an effigy of an owl that gets burnt in the forest.
Ed was invited to that bit.
So when they kept doing that with their hands,
it was a really powerful Masonic lodge.
So naive.
In terms of Trump then, because this is really Brexit and Trump have been the two defining issues of the year, how much do you despair about the outcome of both of those elections?
More than I did on the election night. And I felt pretty bad election night, because actually, you know, there was this, when he clearly was going to win the Republican nomination, he actually did a quite consensual speech back in April, May, just after Ohio. But actually, his cabinet appointments seem to be, you know, much more extreme and less consensual and more crazy than I was hoping for. And so it feels as though the one thing we knew was that it was going to be about a very uncertain time because he's so unpredictable. But the people he's choosing to appoint are worse than I expected. So I felt pretty bad on election night, but I feel worse now.
And Alistair, you worked with George W. Bush, who at the time was really ridiculed, and I always thought a lot of that ridicule was unfair. Now in Donald Trump, there is someone actually who genuinely is as bad as people fear, it seems. If you were working, if there was a Labour government in this country now, what would you advise them to do in terms of dealing with Donald Trump?
Well, I thought Angela Merkel got the tone absolutely right on the day he won. She made it about values. And I thought when Trump came out and said Nigel Farage should be our ambassador to the UK... And then number 10's line was, there isn't a vacancy at the moment. And I honestly think she should have come out and said, look, I am responsible for my team, you're responsible for your team, this is not a game. And my big fear, there was a fantastic piece I read yesterday from the Atlantic. Now these psychiatrist guys, they shouldn't really do psychiatric analysis of people in public life, I don't think, but this guy was brilliant. And it was basically about Trump, and it was building the case that he is a genuinely sick narcissist. And the worry I have about Trump is everything, large and small, is about him and how it affects him. I came out tonight, I've become obsessed with it. I've got to stop looking at his Twitter feed. And he did a tweet tonight saying that Vanity Fair circulation figures are a joke. And what's the name, Graydon Carter, what his name is? Is going to lose his job? About time too. And I'm thinking, he's tweeting about the editor of a magazine being unfit to be the editor. And as Ed says, these appointments, they're terrifying. I mean, you know, and it's all about, so like the Taiwan thing. Now, maybe he didn't know, that's bad enough, but maybe he didn't know. He does the call, and rather than saying then, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't have done that, he feels, well, I have to defend that because I did that. And therefore he starts doing all this stuff attacking China. And I'll tell you, I can remember, next time you see your mate Tony Blair, when we first met Vladimir Putin in 1997, I remember Tony saying, he's all right, we'll get on with him. And that's Trump's stance at the moment.
Yeah.
And Putin will rumble around him. And I just think it's becoming a kind of international, global joke. But it's not funny. It's really, really serious. And I'm actually quite scared about it.
I was out at... in the US last week, and after the election, they have this sort of day where they get up to Harvard, they get all of the campaign and media people from both sides, and they came, and it was actually quite a big bust-up event, quite a difficult event, I think. Interestingly, Harvard had this big debate about whether or not they should ban, there was a big student demonstration saying they should ban the Trump campaign from even coming to the Leap Team because they were racist and people wouldn't feel comfortable in their presence, and I don't think that's the right response. But the thing which I thought was really chilling in the reports of it was that at key moments, the Trump advisors were explaining, the very senior advisors, that at key moments they would advise him to take a particular course, and then he himself personally would choose to take the absolute opposite course. Mm-hmm. So do you remember the one they had where he was very offensive about a judge who was... ethnic minority, I can't remember exactly what the...
Mexican.
Sorry?
Mexican.
That's right. And the advisors all said, they advised him to go out and apologise immediately. And Trump personally just decides, sod that, he goes out and sort of and does the opposite. He reinforces the message and is even more hostile. And
he did it with our war hero, he did it with he's one of those guys who can't back down.
Even when advised, he goes and does the opposite, and that's a complete nightmare, because then the guy's completely...
And now this thing, you know, he's got this thing that Kellyanne Conway is on television today saying that it'd be really good if you had Ivanka and her husband in the White House in an official capacity. I mean, if that was like an African dictatorship, we'd all be saying this is just unbelievable that they're thinking of this, but they're thinking of it and they're going
to
do it.
But if you were working for a British Prime Minister and you had to deal with President Trump...
I would follow the Merkel handbook.
But one-to-one, if you met him, how would you sort of
deal? You've got to try to get on with it. Yeah. You've got to try to get on with
engage.
It. Yes. But don't pander.
But if you're in a working relationship with a guy like him, you couldn't last, could you? You couldn't stay in that relationship, even if you were being a hard gun. Because if at the end there's not a sense of commonality and he doesn't listen, he just does his own thing, then you have to get out straight away. And the interesting thing will be who's actually willing to go and work with him. That's so important in the American system. The answer is nothing. I fear. They're the only ones that are going
to
do it.
Mildly inappropriate language. Speaking of my mental health campaigning hat on.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. But the thing is, I mean, somebody once said, when I saw today, Roger Ailes, the Fox guy, had just been booted out for sexual harassment. And he's thinking of appointing him as Under Secretary for Public Diplomacy. and you think, is that fake news? But it came from the Hill people, who are usually kind of quite close to it. And you almost think it's like, this is why I'm sorry to go back to the reality TV thing. I mean, this is the guy, Trump, who the day after he won, he said, I'm the only guy who knows who the contestants are for Secretary of State. The contestants. And he wheels them in, Mitt Romney, Giuliani. Yeah. And then he thinks, no, they're not nearly offensive enough to get this guy Tillerson on the phone. Stereotypes. And Brexit. At least you can get rid of Trump. Brexit, I'm afraid we can't get rid of it.
But I think, you know, to go back to your point earlier, I mean, I think reality TV is okay so long as you know the difference.
Right.
And I think, you know, I was on Strictly Come Dancing, but I know that's not the same as being...
I have
a feeling that our problem with this is that he doesn't actually understand that distinction.
I think it's absolutely right. Nor do a lot of the people who voted for it. And I think what's incredible about Trump at the moment is the normal democratic deal is you stand for election, you get elected, and you say, right, I'm going to roll my sleeves up and do the things we got elected to do. The world is breathing a sigh of relief every time he says, no, I didn't mean that, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to lock Hillary up. I'm not going to build a wall that's going to be a fence. Thank God for that, I'm going to build a wall. And it's like, it just turns democracy upside down. And I do feel sorry for these other leaders, because they're going to have to, Putin's absolutely on the rampage, Theresa May's, you know, new and finding a way, Angela Merkel's, I think, terrific, but, you know, fourth term, that's a big, big ask. You've got the situation in France, where, honestly, do not rule out the possibility of Le Pen, because this guy Fillon, he is going to be portrayed the same as Brexit was, the same as Hillary was, as the establishment. And he's very, very right-wing. He'll tack over there. A lot of the socialists won't vote for him. So I think he'll be okay. But, I mean, the fact that we're even having to worry that a very, very right-wing Frenchman will become president to stop this. And then Farage, I don't know if you've seen his Christmas card today. His Christmas card is him and Trump. Right, and it says, looking forward to lots more fun in 2017. And what he means by that is Le Pen.
Yeah.
He means trying to wreck the euro and Austria and all the rest of it. It's this, that's what he means by it. And we've just got to understand this is really, really dangerous.
So the big question is, how do you defeat someone like Donald Trump?
Now or in the past?
Now.
I think Hillary, for the campaign, either of us would have advised her to fight based on experience, on stability, on continuity, on being serious, dangers in the world, how you meet them. He dragged her down. And also, I've got to say, Bernie Sanders took it, helped him.
Yeah.
The whole thing about Hillary as a creature of Goldman Sachs,
yeah.
He started all that, and Trump just thought, oh, this is going well. And on he went. So I think you've got to be very, very careful. And don't forget, and honestly, every single person should tweet this every single day. He lost the popular vote by 2.5 million. So Hillary actually did okay. But so how do you defeat him now? I think we've got to stop this normalisation. I feel the same about Brexit. We've got to stop pretending that it's okay. We've got to stop pretending that it's going to be fine. And we've got to fight it.
But with Brexit, exit from the European Union, unless you have another referendum, it would be undemocratic for that to be blocked or to be frustrated in the long term. We are going to leave the European Union. At least with Donald Trump, you've got a chance in 4 years to defeat him.
That's why I think Brexit's more dangerous in a way.
But, well, I agree, but...
Yeah, partly that.
You are?
No, but listen, where is it saying in the Constitution that if you lose a vote, you lose a referendum, you have to start believing the nonsense that people like you told? Why do I have to believe? And I think MPs who think, and I believe Theresa May is among them, who think as they go through these negotiations, this is a total disaster for this country. I think they have a responsibility to stand up and say so. And most of them, in my view, believe that.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Given that that went well, let's take some more questions from the audience. The house lights up a bit, and we'll take three or four. If I could ask for one sentence questions and one sentence answers from you both,
okay,
if that's okay. So the chat.
Well, don't forget, I've got my selection box.
Oh, so Alison, and what's that for?
The best question in our view.
Okay, so the best question in your view. Yes, the chat right at the back there. What would you buy Corbyn for Christmas?
Strategy.
I suppose you never had to think of this.
Just, I think it's really important that somebody explains to him that having a public meeting of 1,000 people is not the same as winning a general election. And I don't know how I can explain that to him. I don't know what president I can on.
Well, you know, 400's good though, right? Yes, the lady over there.
Trillions of pounds that it is given generously,
with big part,
all sorts of things like the NHS, decades, and also the things more recently.
It's a really long sentence. So, in a nutshell?
That Britain should remunerate itself, allow itself to print a certain amount of money.
Quantitative easing.
Stop asking a
messy,
not a question!
Right, don't start turning on each other. We've had enough of that this year. So would they support more quantitative easing, I guess? Is that right? More printing of money? Chaps.
Ed. Come on, you want to be Chancellor.
I think the quantitative easing was the right thing to do when the problem in the economy was a massive deficiency of demand. But it feels as though we may be moving into a different phase now, which is actually that for a range of reasons, including the slowness of this recovery, our underlying kind of capacity potential is quite weak. And in those circumstances, I think simply doing more and more monetary policy isn't going to work. So it doesn't surprise me that the Fed, the Bank of England, and now the ECB are pulling away from quantitative easing, not because it wasn't the right thing to do, but I think it may have run its course.
Okay, Alistair?
You don't know me.
Okay. Oh, yes, the chap there waving.
What role can Tony Blair play in the fight against the hard Brexit, if any, and can
he help to stop it? Can he even help to stop it?
I feel like there aren't many of us saying, I really, really understand why it's so difficult for MPs, and I'm not an MP, and I don't particularly want to be an MP, but I feel that if you've got a voice, and you can raise it, and Tony Blair clearly has a voice and the ability to raise it, I think he will raise it to keep putting the arguments and forcing people to challenge the nonsenses that we're having to believe and accept. I mean, the lady just talked there about trillions. When Philip Hammond stood up and talked about $2 trillion debt, I mean, in the past, that would have been, okay, that's your economic heading for the rocks, what are we going to do about that? It's all, I feel like we're in a plane, we know it's going to crash, but we say, well, we've just got to carry on. And so I think whether it can be stopped, I don't know, but I think he will play a role in challenging some of these nonsenses that keep being pushed our way.
I have a different view from Alistair, which is not to say that I'm not really worried about him, the course we're on and what Brexit means. And personally, I think there being voices in the debate now talking about what the consequences could be and the choices which we face is a good thing. If Tony Blair is one of those voices, that's a good thing. But I think you have to be quite careful when out there a lot of people feel as though they voted for Brexit against the advice of the established order and the advice of people who told them it would all be a disaster. I think I think people are going to need time to reach the conclusion that it's a disaster, if that's the right thing.
Yeah, by the time it triggers Article 50, we're into these negotiations, we're out, there's no way back, so...
Yeah. Well, I don't think, I think a lot of people voted the other way, and I think that it's important that you respect and engage with their views rather than dismiss them. And I'm not saying you are, but I think something that there's a danger. If you just say, isn't the problem that Jeremy Corbyn's view of people is that when they vote the other way, he just tells them that you're wrong? And I'm not sure whether that's always the best way to persuade swing voters to change their minds. It seems to me that there is in the Brexit debate, there is 10% of people who think we should stay and come what may, and there is a group on the other side which is bigger than 10% who think we should leave whatever, and there's a big chunk in the middle, some of whom voted for in, some of whom voted for out, who are quite pragmatic. And you've got to engage pragmatically in that centre ground argument. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sorry to sound more New Labour than you on this one.
Yes, the gentleman right down the barrel there.
The really funny thing, I've got to tell you that I did loads and loads of interviews about Strictly Come Dancing, but there were also a bit of politics over the last 3 months. And Katya would be there while I was doing them because we were talking about, and she's really good. She can answer questions now on Brexit or on Corbyn or whatever. She can say, Jeremy Corbyn, I mean, he's still got a lot to prove, whether he actually can really show that he can be a leader of a prime minister rather than just, it's all very well to have 1,000 people cheering, but she'd say, but he's got to listen to the swingers. All the swingers in the marginal constituencies. And I would say, well, no, it's not really swingers. They're like swing voters, but swingers, and because she's Russian, she doesn't always get the language. Swingers is kind of a different thing to swing voters. Like fluffers, really. So I spent a lot of time trying to explain to her that, Jeremy Corbyn may not be appealing to the swingers, but it's not clear that me and Alistair want you either.
Yes, the chap right down the barrel there.
How to think in a post-Iraq world, I'm thinking particularly of Syria and Aleppo. We've rebuilt the case for liberal interventionism globally.
How to rebuild the case for liberal interventionism, taking the context of Aleppo.
In one sentence.
In one sentence.
I voted against the David Cameron proposal on Syria 3 years ago.
Was that because you were whipped?
Well, we were whipped, but I think it was the right thing to do to vote against. Because I thought that at the time, David Cameron, and I think to be honest, President Obama as well, had no plan, they had no strategy, nobody knew how this was going to work. The thing which frustrated me was that David Cameron's attitude at that point was then, okay, well then, that's it then. And it's sort of, and disengaged. And I think that lots of us who voted against it at that time weren't voting against intervention. We didn't think the case had been made, and that David Cameron explained what he was trying to do. I think the same thing was true in the autumn of last year as well, although that time he won the vote. I think if you're going to make the case for liberal interventionism, you've got to be able to show people that you've got a plan and a strategy, and it's not just stage one, stage two, and stage three after that. You've got to, it may not be always possible to get a UN resolution, but you need an international consensus. And I think the problem in Syria has been the weakness of West leadership, but also that when people lost and had some setbacks 2 or 3 years ago, they then gave up.
And I think, the other tragedy, I think, of what's happened in the States is that the real powers in the... I mean, Russia is actually a declining power in some ways, but he has real power in this stuff now. And I think we've allowed that. And I think the problem with Syria began, to my mind, when you can't have a situation where a respected Western leader like Obama says, if this guy uses chemical weapons, that is a red line. If he crosses that red line, then we will take the necessary action. And then it doesn't happen. And there's all sorts of reasons why it doesn't happen. And democracy is complicated. And it's true that the British parliamentary vote had an impact on the decision of the Americans. No doubt about that. But I think where we go now, and this is why you've asked your question about how you deal with people like Trump, you do have to have relations with these people now. Because, and the whole thing, the way that we can look at the pictures of Aleppo at the moment, and the extent to which they become normalised, become sensitised to them. And my worry, I fear, it's interesting that Ed just said there, you might not be able to get the United Nations resolution. The United Nations is actually becoming virtually dysfunctional. And the reason for that is because it's developed a system post-war. The big five, the idea of the permanent five in the Security Council, well, China tends to opt out. Russia now utterly, doesn't even hide the facts, utterly opposed to anything. Britain, in my view, post-Brexit, unlikely to keep its place, because a lot of our power at the moment does come through the diplomatic actions that we take with the rest of the European Union. So I think there's going to have to be a reframing of those international structures. And how that happens, what the framework becomes, I don't know. But I feel that the current international structures are becoming completely dysfunctional. And the other thing that's happening is that non-democracies and pseudo-democracies are now operating at an advantage to the democracies. That is a real danger. And I just don't think we are alive to the dangers of that. So it's a dark, depressing place, international diplomacy at the moment.
It is. And let's not let that turn this room into a dark place. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time now. Sorry, we have no more time for questions.
Oh, come on, one more.
Yes, the lady down here.
Thank you.
Quick question, quick answer.
That'd be good. There's a chocolate box here for you. It's good.
Okay.
He's winning so far.
So it's all of you, but for Ed in particular. I heard anecdotally, but I believe it's factually true, that the day after the referendum, the most Googled term was, what is the EU? So do you think people really knew what they were voting for?
Did people know what they were voting for in the referendum?
Yeah, I'm going to give you the chocolate because you're nearer.
That's how politics works.
She's given to a neighbour. That's nice.
I think, look, I was hugely frustrated with David Cameron and the strategy he took. I think everybody knows that things aren't going as well as they should in our country and in our relations with the rest of the world, and therefore in some sense our European partners. And he basically went off and said, I've renegotiated it, it's all okay, and you can just vote for the status quo. And most people who voted the other way voted because they thought, actually, David Cameron's status quo isn't good enough and I want change. And what that change was, and whether people would see it as a particular change to the EU or to a budget or to a policy, the choice was, as they are, or change, and they voted for change. And almost in any change is better than the status quo. And so, and you don't need to have to know what the EU is to think that I don't like things how they are, I want to vote for change. And so, in that context, you've got to be, in the end, Hillary didn't persuade people that she was going to change things, which is why she lost. And the Brexit argument, the Remain argument was a status quo argument, and that lost. Because I think at the moment, people are very frustrated, they want things to change. And that doesn't have to mean they have to understand the institutions of the EU, or even what the EU is. They just want things to change.
But doesn't that still mean it's the wrong answer?
It's in those circumstances, having a referendum is bloody stupid.
Yeah.
And it's not like we didn't tell him.
You see, I think populism. People think populism is the voice of the people. I think that is populism. To me, is what happens when emotion trumps argument, and when detail and reason is defeated by anger and feeling. And I think that's what's happening in our politics at the moment, everywhere. And I don't see at the moment how we're going to wrestle that back. That's why I do keep mentioning Angela Merkel. I mean, she's the one sort of big leader on the world stage who seems to still be able to command respect with that approach. Trump is the absolute extreme of this, but so is Putin.
But if you take the problems Angela Merkel's had, the biggest issue in the Brexit vote, and Donald Trump's biggest argument was all about immigration.
Yeah.
And in the immigration
argument... Merkel's talking about that in America.
Sorry?
Merkel's talking about that in America.
Well, and...
as a response to populism.
Having allowed a very large migration to occur for very understandable reasons, given domestic political context. I think, though, what people heard in the referendum is David Cameron saying, free movement's good for you. And I think most people think free movement, free market, free for all. I don't like that, and I want somebody to get a grip. And actually, the only answer, you know, I'm afraid migration is a massive economic and social and identity issue. You can see that shaping politics all around the developed world. It will be the biggest issue in the French election as well. And you've got three choices. You say, you know, we're going to stick with the status quo because free movement's good for you. You can say, let's shut the borders and be autarkic. Or you've got to say, let's find a way to manage this process and get control. And I'm afraid that that middle argument was taken by the outs rather than the in. And that was a terrible mistake. David Cameron should have been for managing migration, so should the Labour Party, and we
were.
You know, it is linked to that's popular, and outside of Linkedin, it's very unpopular.
No. Hold on, let me just say this, because honestly, this is really important. The thing about Cameron, the other thing, you cannot turn around 20, 30 years of scepticism in the governing party by suddenly saying, I can persuade the country in a referendum. So, you know, he shouldn't have had the referendum, partly because he never laid the ground for the argument.
And we didn't do enough to combat that scepticism when we were in government.
I agree. Well, that was a nice way to end it.
Well, that's not fully the end. We're going to have a good old dance and a sing song, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm not dancing.
Firstly, do thank. Please do give it up for our two fantastic guests, Ed Balls and Alistair Campbell.
My word. What an experience that was. I mean, it was, you kind of get the sense of it through the recording, but really, I remember Alistair Campbell actually being annoyed with me. He said I hadn't given him the correct cue to come on, so I think he felt that he'd either come out too early or too late playing the bagpipes, but I don't think anyone really, I mean, once you hear the bagpipes, you know someone's playing the bagpipes, and what a treat. Alistair Campbell playing the bagpipes, while Ed Balls, a very talented dancer, danced away. Two stars of podcasting now as well. Welcome to the club, fellas. These live shows of the political party will return. When I have more news, I'll let you know. Check my social media. I'm on Twitter at Matt Ford, and I'll keep you updated on there, because these messages are pre-recorded before I've gone into hospital. So hopefully sometime soon I will be able to announce some live dates back at the Duchess Theatre. Until then, I shall keep curating this series from the past, and I'll see you next week. Ta-ra. Bye.